Hey guys, this is Greg Soul with the Brothers Whiffs, number 29. Mike just, number 30. Mike just verified. So the last one was 29. This is 30. This is early August. Yeah. So we've got me, Greg Soul. Up here, you've got Mike Hammett. You've got Andrew Cox, all the way from Australia. I'm not going to tell you where Mike's from because it doesn't matter. Thomas, all the way from Slovakia. Again, you wonderful, wonderful gentleman. Mike, say hi.
Hello.
Andrew, say hi.
Hello.
And then Thomas.
Dobrý večer.
Always got to one-up everybody. Always got to be that guy. No. I had actually bothered to listen to one of our podcasts, and I noticed that we didn't always say hi after we were introduced, so you couldn't always tell who was who when we were speaking, so I thought it might actually be a good idea for us to introduce our voices as well. So this one, it looks like it's going to be more just kind of news, things that have been going on in the community lately, which is good. Right, we don't have any dedicated topics, and I kind of like these because they end up going off on tangents. And well, Tom's not here, so they're not going to go off on too far of a tangent. But it's always kind of fun to figure out where we're going to end up. So, top of the list is Ubiquiti actually hit with a street price, and I think I'm not sure if they had a release date, but they're talking about the Ubiquiti Edge Switch 16XG, and that is going to be their 16-port 10-gig switch, right? So I actually kind of looked through the spec sheets and everything, which I've been lazy about lately, but I finally got around to looking at it. And it's got 12 SFP Plus ports, and then it's got four copper 10-gig ports that also do double as gig ports, right? So you can actually do gig on those as well. I'm not sure if you're going to be able to stick in an SFP in the SFP Plus slots or not. I don't see anybody nodding their head whether you could.
I think 1/10 for both the SFP Plus and the RJ45.
Okay, excellent. Because I know a lot of guys that maybe want to kind of future-proof their installs are going to want to go with this, and they're just not ready for 10 gig, right? So having that 1 gig option would be really nice. So it looked like, I'm trying to pull this off the top of my head, I'm sure Mike's staring at the spec sheet on it, but it was something like 255 VLANs, which is pretty ample for most enterprises, right? I don't know a lot of people running more VLANs than that. It does regular spanning tree, rapid spanning tree, multi-spanning tree, which is, it seems weird that we would even bother to mention that when we're talking about a switch, because that's such a standard feature, right, guys? But a lot of switches we've been seeing pumping out lately, aka the MikroTik CRS line, doesn't have any spanning tree, no loop prevention whatsoever, right? So this has it built in, which is tremendous. I know Thomas relies heavily. I know some people out there aren't fans of spanning tree. I personally run it a lot. And I know, Thomas, you run a lot of spanning tree infrastructure, don't you?
Yes, we have a highly redundant layer 2 infrastructure where we run a lot of LHCP trunks and spanning tree as well. So we have pretty much a fully meshed layer 2 core, which is running spanning tree as a way to keep it loop free. And we have a bunch of fiber links, which are backed up by wireless links, which are also, of course, run by spanning tree. So I really like spanning tree.
Gotcha. So it's critical to your environment, right?
Definitely.
So you're saying if it was a switch that you wanted to deploy and it didn't have it, that's a no-go for you, right?
There is basically, like, I guess, 4 or 5 major features that I think every single switch that I would even consider deploying should have, which is, of course, LHCP, so link aggregation control protocol, then spanning tree, then LLDP, then radius login into the switch, and... I'm pretty sure. And, of course, very good SNMP support.
Okay.
So those are, like, the 5 things which I personally think every single serious good switch should have.
All right. So just making a note, you said LACP, Link Aggregation Control Protocol, right? Which is 802.1AD,
I think, right? AD.
And so that's for you Cisco guys, that's Ether Channel. For you Linux guys, that's bonding, right? It's where you take multiple interfaces, you bond them together, and you can create a lag, right? A lag is Juniper guys.
Link aggregation group, yeah.
Right, and then I think Brocade calls it a lag too. Everybody's got their own nomenclature, right? It equates to the same thing, where you bundle multiple interfaces together and go into a chassis, which gives you more throughput but also some resiliency, right? So if one of those links fails, you don't have as much throughput, but guess what? Your traffic is still moving, which is great.
Well, in theory, the things which you mentioned, like a leg, is just a general nomenclature for link bonding, right? But it's very also important to have the LHCP protocol support, because LHCP is the standardized way to do bonding. So a lot of the switches actually will tell you they have bonding on there, or they have some support of a LAC link aggregation group, but they will only do static groups, or they will do proprietary protocols to implement this, which is not very good usually for you, because obviously you want to keep your network as vendor agnostic and as standards based as possible. So not just having a lag or a bonding functionality by itself, but it being LHCP is also very important.
Gotcha. Something I've found that Bytes people is saying always or never, right? So why should we change from using EIGRP? We're always going to use Cisco devices, you know, to route with, right? Or why should we switch from PAGP? We're always going to use, you know, so it's never limit yourself, right? If you stick with the open standard, odds are you're going to be able to interoperate with different vendors, which is tremendous. One thing I noted on there was, and something that Andrew Thrift is always harping on, is MLAG, or multi-chassis lag, where you can have multiple 1U switches all logically connected together, and you can do a lag from the top switch to the bottom switch, right? So it's a bonding group between multiple pieces of hardware, which really adds a lot of resiliency to it. So it didn't say anything about that in the initial release, but again, this is initial release, right? This could be a feature that they theoretically add. I think even the TP links, like the Jetstream, they have some sort of multi-chassis lag or MLAG. I've never tested it. I haven't actually talked to anybody else that has, but it's an interesting feature, right?
I'm actually running it. Andrew Thrift likes to point out that I have ancient switches from Extreme running an ancient OS.
Well, I saw people on the Nanog list saying that, yeah, those are ancient too, so he's not alone.
You know, they have 10 gig ports. They've got, you know, all the functionality. I have them set up in an MLAG setup with my vSphere hosts. I've got, from each host, I have two connections going to each switch. And my SAN, so that way I can completely lose one switch and I still have plenty of, you know, SAN connectivity, plenty of vMotion capacity, and it's just all managed through one interface. It's nice.
Yeah.
My Brocade switches, they do a little bit differently through their proprietary version of Trill, kind of wraps up STP and LACP into something better than all of the above, but proprietary.
Right, so Trill is kind of like Spanning Tree Protocol NG, like next generation, right?
It's that and more.
Yeah.
It has many more different features.
Yeah, so and we're definitely getting sidetracked here, but Trill has some functionality kind of like OSPF, right? It sort of can find best path on a layer 2 network sort of thing, isn't that?
Yeah, it's, you know, I don't have a huge infrastructure with it, but in the infrastructure I do have, and I understand it does continue as you scale, once you configure the you know, group, you just plug any port on any switch into any port on any switch, and it figures it out.
That's it. Magic.
And unlike STP, where you only have one traffic path, every path is a traffic path.
Okay, cool. All right, so Thomas, you said LACP was one of your mandatory. You said radius authentication, I guess back to a centralized authentication point. So individual users, when they're logging in to manage the device, will have to authenticate. And I know the switch does support it. So I think it said Radius, remote protocols. It does Telnet. It does SSH. It also has a web interface to configure. So that's two of the lists. What were the other ones you had on the list?
Well, so Spanning Tree, which we discussed, LHCP, which we discussed, Radius, which we discussed, decent SNMP support, including actually exposing all of the proper information inside of the proper MIPS. That's also very important.
And I know it says SNMP, right? But everything says SNMP, and that doesn't mean from version to version it's going to be consistent or the OIDs won't magically change or things won't stop. So we don't
also
have any insight.
The important thing here is also to actually expose all of the proper data. For example, you can have a switch which has LLDP and spanning tree, but if it doesn't expose those information over SNMP, then they are much less useful to you and to your whole overall infrastructure. Same thing with obviously exposing all of the proper addressing tables and mapping tables and etc. over SNMP. Basically, if your vendor is going to implement SNMP, SNMP is pretty much useless without all the proper information you want being exposed in it in a standardized way, so in the MIPS, which should expose that information.
Okay. And the last you mentioned right there, again, was LLDP, and from the switch docs, it actually does say it supports LLDP, so it hit your, at least on paper, it's hit your top five criteria, right? Until we put it through paces, who can really say? Some of the other things I noticed in there, it said that it's capable of running a DHCP server, which to me is a little weird for a switch. I think it said up to something like 2,000 leases somewhere in that neighborhood, which I guess for an average MDU or average site, that's going to be pretty much all you need. I can't remember how many pools, something like 100 pools or something like that? Or
128
pools. So
how is that? Can I expect to Radius as well, or is that just standalone?
The docs don't really get into it enough. Only has kind of a spec sheet and then a quick start guide, so there's not really a lot of info on that.
On this particular switch, if there's anything that you guys or any of the crowd wants specifically tested, let us know. Someone may be getting one to put through the paces.
Yeah, very cool.
I'd definitely be interested in seeing that someone test more of the Ethernet SFP functionality, because I know that's a problem we've struggled with some of the existing models, that it's only certain SFPs are supported, and some of them are only supported at gigabit. And yeah,
gotcha.
So seeing that, given they're coming out with an SFP switch and making sure it actually works with different brands of SFPs and things would be good.
Gotcha. So compatibility questions, right? Excellent. I know you've been talking about it recently, having optic compatibility issues. I know Mike's been having compatibility issues with, or at least getting his optics flashed properly from the factory when they come in. So it's very much a concern for a lot of... Andrew, I'm thinking you had to use some Cisco-branded optics in something. Is that right?
It wasn't optics as such. It was actually we were trying to work with a couple of the 24-port ones that have SFPs on the end. And because we were using the full 24 ports for PoE, we were using the SFPs for uplinks. But in this case, it wasn't a fiber uplink. It needed to be just gigabit Ethernet. And yeah, all of the modules we had floating around, which was like three or four different brands, none of them were recognized, or they were only recognized when you locked the port to 1,000 megabit, no auto negotiation or anything, which is supposed to be used in gigabit Ethernet. You're supposed to have auto negotiation enabled. And even then, when they came up, they weren't parsing traffic correctly. So in the support ticket we raised and everything, they were like, oh, you should just use Cisco Ethernet SFPs. And said, well, we're buying this switch because it's relatively cheap by comparison. We don't want to have to go out and spend like half the price of the switch on actual Cisco gigabit Ethernet modules and things. So.
Did they say it actually had to be Cisco branded or Cisco compatible?
They said Cisco brand, like they said Cisco modules, but I assume that any Cisco compatible Ethernet module should work. So it's just a case of getting some of those in and trying it.
Okay. Let's see. You know, it's interesting that you say it because I have some Nexus 5020, some Cisco Nexus 5020 switches, and they'll run, like, the first half of the ports will run 10 gig or 1 gig, and the last half are only 10 gig. And those first ones, if you want them to run at a gig, I think you have to statically assign the speed as 1,000 as well.
Yeah, turn up auto neg.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just kind of wacky. What else? Going back to that switch, what else was there? There some routing functionality. So again,
I actually want to get back to DHCP. I have a question for you guys. So how do you deploy your DHCP servers in a bigger install which requires DHCP?
Bigger installs, which I usually just do it right on the MikroTik. And I've
honestly
had good success so far.
Say you don't have one central router, say it's multiple buildings which have multiple routers which need to have multiple switches, say it's a bigger let's say enterprise customer or maybe, you know, SMB customer or some similar deploy. Again, this goes back to the switch having DHCP capability. How do you guys usually deal with deploys like that?
Or I've done it also, if it's an enterprise, the router, they usually don't want the router doing DHCP. They want that going back to one of the domain controllers that's running DHCP so that they get auto-registered for, like, WIN services and all that weird old stuff. And for that, I've used just, like, DHCP relay functionality. Where
and that was exactly what I was getting into. So we do exactly the same thing. And not just because you need Active Directory, because in some instances you don't need Active Directory, right? But you definitely have to have a centralized DHCP server. You don't want to have 20 DHCP, different DHCP servers to manage with on 20 different devices and etc. So for me, it's kind of surprising that a switch itself would have a DHCP server functionality. I definitely expect it should have a DHCP relay functionality, and I guess that's why I was asking how you guys deploy it, because my personal, the way I've been doing it, and my personal recommendation would be to just roll out a single DHCP server and relay that all across the network. And for that, of course, your switches are fairly good as a DHCP relay, but running the switch as a DHCP server for me is kind of questionable.
Yeah, it's just some of the functionality in the switch baffles me a bit right now. So, right, they have DHCP in there, so it can hand out 2,000 addresses, which is going to be, say, in an MDU environment, that's usually going to be more than you're ever going to need. As well as it's got some basic routing functionality. So you can have up to 16 static routes, or 15, I think, and then you can have, like, policy-based routing, a few entries as well. And so it perplexes me, you know, why... And you can have...
Go ahead. To me, it just looks like they've gone like, well, we can add this functionality in, and it makes the device on the whole more flexible. So why not? I mean, I don't picture that most people are going to be deploying it going, oh, I'm putting it in here because it can handle, like, can do DHCP and it can do routing. But in a pinch, it's like, well, we can do DHCP on this device. So it's there, it's available. It makes it, more appealing as a product because it has those options if you run into cases requiring them. So for me, it's like,
yeah, true. Yeah, it's I guess the alternative is knowing what the chipset supports and then saying, well, why didn't Ubiquiti add support for that feature that the chipset has? You know,
because it was already there. Well, I don't know. I think of it too. I can wear a thong bathing suit or a Speedo and go to the grocery store and do my shopping, but just because I can doesn't necessarily mean I should.
And that's also a very important point that it may also encourage bad practices, right? There might be people who don't know better, or there might be people who think it's a good idea to run 2,000 DHCP clients of your switch, right? So I am not personally against any of these functions being in there, but I'm just hoping people don't use them in the wrong way.
Yeah, because a year from now we'll get emails from someone going, I'm using this as a DHCP client, and you're looking and going, but why?
Yeah, that's not the proper way to do it. Yeah. I mean, like Andrew said, it's nice in a pinch, or if you have a very specific use case, but usually there are better standard industry best practices ways to do it, which to people who don't know them, it might seem like a good idea to do it. You know, my switch supports routing, it supports NAT, it supports DHCP server. Okay, so I'll just put in one switch and it will do everything, you know, from VLANs through access layer, through DHCP, through routing, through netting. And, well, you know how that's going to turn out later on when the network expands.
Yeah, and also I didn't see any documentation on what kind of processor this switch has, so theoretically it may not be that powerful, so I don't know if it could really handle that much throughput when it's actually routing.
That's the point, right? But since the functionality is there, again, it might suggest to some people that, yeah, I'll just use it as a router as well. And again, I am not against those features being in there. I'm just hoping they are not used in the incorrect way.
Yeah. Something else I was thinking about is it's got very extensive quality of service built in as well, right? Which is great. It's just, I don't know. You know, the target market that they're shooting at least in my mind, right? There are WISPs and they're marketing to WISPs and things like that. This thing has 16 10 gig ports. How many WISPs do you know that are pushing it that hard that would actually need quality of service?
Actually, yeah, that's my question on you guys. How many of you do QoS on layer 2?
You know what? I used to do it probably 8 years ago, but now, I mean, you know,
these days,
costs me $5, you know, for full gig or something like that per port. So I have so much more throughput than I would ever need on every one of these switches. And every switch that I've bought in the last 7 years has been line rate across everything, you know. It's like some of the old Ciscos, like the 3550s, you know, they'd have 12 gig ports, but they could only support 10 gigs across the backplane, right? It's you don't see that anymore. So do you guys even really use layer 2 QoS anymore? I don't.
I would like to have it across the board, but I don't have that time. I mean,
yeah,
in my ideal world, I would configure it everywhere it could be configured, but I don't have time for that.
Not just that, but if any of you guys even in the past deployed layer 2 QoS, you know how much work it is to actually have it done properly, for it to actually work, to actually enforce all the proper tagging and everything. And it's just a massive time investment to implement it and to keep it going and to maintain it, to monitor it and everything else. So that's why I was asking if any of you guys even considered layer 2 QoS a valid option with today's interface speeds and prices and everything else. Because like Greg said, I don't do layer 2 QoS anymore either.
Yeah,
I would say layer 2 and even layer 3 QoS at small scale is just a huge time sink. Like as Greg pointed out, in most cases, and this isn't just with your switching infrastructure, this is getting the same way with your upstream transits and things. If you look at the amount of time it's going to take you to roll out layer 2 or layer 3 QoS, and you go, well, what's the alternative? Like replacing the switch with something that has like higher port speed, higher port density, it's going to solve my problems. And I can do that as a once-off, or I can buy more upstream bandwidth from my transit provider. Otherwise, yeah, you're having to go through every part of your network and update your rates and make sure that everything's being queued correctly. The trade-off in one versus the other is that time sync versus the cost, and the cost is always coming down.
And
not just that, it's also about customer satisfaction, right? Because if you are doing QoS, you wouldn't do it if you have enough traffic. So you will do QoS when you run into traffic limits, and it's also a better customer experience if you don't do QoS, but rather, you know, give them all the traffic that they are purchasing from you or that they should get. So I think even from a user experience point of view, it even, you know, adds all the pluses of rather having more speed available rather than doing QoS add up to a point where I personally think, like you guys also said, that just buying more at this point is cheaper, easier, less complexity as well, less configuration, and more user satisfaction. So,
yeah. How far down this QoS rabbit hole do we want to go?
Probably not too terribly far. One last thing, though, I did have one more thing to add, is because I have done layer 2 QoS in the past. And when you're moving from switch model to switch, you know, even in the same manufacturer, switch model to switch model, it's got different hardware buffering. It's got different queuing mechanisms. So there's not like a common QoS that, oh, this is all Cisco. I can just paste the same thing across the board. It's not. It's different switch to switch. And so...
And not just that, like tag translation, re-tagging, and all of those issues, which we hopefully today don't even think about anymore. But
I've been reading about SDN, software defined networking, is the future, and that is a rabbit hole where I am not prepared to go down right now. But something that immediately popped into mind is I heard an interview with one of the Meraki sales guys, and he was talking about how they basically have an easy button for QoS now, and Meraki has this cloud based administration for their switches and their routers, right? So you go into the cloud and you basically say, apply the QoS policy, and it just magically does it for you. You don't have to go in there and build all the stuff. So to me, that's like the most ideal sort of quality. I guess you sacrifice some amount of control, right? You can't get in there and tune it quite as much. Or maybe you can with the Meraki stuff. But the fact that you can basically just hit a checkbox and it rolls to all your gear, that's kind of the only way I would think about doing layer 2 QoS anymore, because it's just, I don't want to tie any more nooses to hang myself from.
Isn't Meraki the vendor that if you stop paying the ongoing license fee, your device becomes bricked?
I don't know if it bricks, but I know you can't administer it anymore. I know that. You can't log in to make any changes. I think Aerohive is the same way, right? If you don't pay your license fee for their gear, your controller just stops and you can't get in there and do anything anymore.
Yeah. Yep.
Vendor lock.
In defense of Rockets, like, they have that year to year licensing as well, but if you don't maintain it, you just don't get updates anymore. It's like everything still works on site. You just don't get the new firmware updates. So.
At least you can still control and make some changes, yeah. Right? That's good.
That was not a bad decision there.
Ruckus got purchased by Brocade not too long ago, isn't that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Man, we are really going down the rabbit hole. All right, so and then Meraki got bought by Cisco, which is weird because Meraki's like doing their own thing and Cisco's doing their own thing, and they're putting out two products that can like compete with each other. I don't know what the hell they're doing.
It's the Cisco, Linksys, Meraki, all of that is.
It's weird. Yeah, there's no synergy there. It's like you're one company.
This is more of a business focused observation, but I've always found I don't think it's a bad thing when a company has two competing products, because it's kind of like people look at it and go, well, you've got this product over here that serves this need and this one over here. They're paying money back to the same company, but when you're looking at one versus the other, it's like, oh, there is some depth in the market there. Like we're doing our, as a government department or something, you're doing due diligence, looking at all of the products that are available, even if there's only one company behind those products. And we kind of ran into that with the old business I was working at, where we were one of the biggest providers for X service. Looking at it going, well, if we had another division that was doing a very similar thing, then everyone would be looking at it going, well, it's not just this provider, it's these two options, but pays back to the same place.
Yeah. I think one of the things that strikes me, and that I think I've sort of heard, is that Cisco sells a lot through channel partners, right? You really go straight to Cisco and buy gear. So you go through a channel partner, and if you have all these competing products that are just, you know, like the Meraki does the same thing as this, and then this does the same, you know, how do you translate that to these other resellers and then have them educated when all of this new equipment's pumping out that's doing the same sort of things but slightly different, and then having them actually sell the right solution to an end user? I think the waters probably get a little bit muddy there when they're trying to do that.
The solution in their eyes is whichever one gets the channel partner the biggest rebate or the biggest bonus at the end of the year.
Right. Or the financial industry, they call it yield to broker, right? Whichever mutual fund I can push you off that pays me the most. That's the one. They, financial advisors here, that's a very loose term we use in the U.S. So usually your money's going to go wherever makes them the most money. So let's not get into that, because that's just going to aggravate me. But do you guys have any other? So I was thinking this Ubiquiti Egg Switch, 16 10 gig ports. We didn't even talk about the best part. The street price, or the MSRP, I think is $600, which means street price is going to be what, like $550? Probably somewhere in that neighborhood.
I'm looking at a vendor right now. I can get it for $539.
All right, so we'll say $550 just in case you can't get the super mic discount.
Pretty good price.
So about €600 in Europe.
There you go. So that's, to me, I don't know anybody else pumping out a 10 gig switch near this volume that's configurable in these fashions with the feature set that's close to this price point. So I also see this being a really good option for enterprise, right? Core of some kind of small network, right? You've got a small hosted VM infrastructure. I can see this being a good option.
I assume that they'll probably, in a couple months, they'll probably paint the box white and put the Unify firmware on it, like they have with the other, you know, Edge Switch, Unify Switch. It's the same hardware, just a different color and a, you know, different, you know, OS.
Gotcha.
So then, you know, that I could see fitting into the whole Unify ecosystem.
Gotcha. And for the three people in the whole world that don't know what Unify is, it's basically Ubiquiti's unified manager. So all of their equipment, or the Unify branded equipment, is able to be centrally administered from this one point, right? So they have a router, they have switches, they have access points. Can you do the VoIP phones and stuff like that from Unify? I can't remember.
I'm not sure, because originally they had like their own PBX, but then they stopped doing their own PBX and just did management. And I think the only thing that has the Unify name that isn't manageable in the normal Unify interface is the cameras.
Cameras.
And I think that's just because they have so much stuff going on with the cameras that you can't have one interface that does all that stuff. It's too distinct to blend together.
Yeah, for sure. It seems like cameras would be something you'd want to sort of segregate off from the rest of that. That might kind of blur some lines into sort of secure areas. At least from the myriad of customers and different weird hosting environments they have, sometimes, well, half the time it seems like they separate out the security team from the rest of the network team. So I could see why they would want to do that, just functionally. Let's see what else. Do you guys have any other insights, opinions on these switches?
I do see they have both the AC and DC versions. I believe the DC has the capability of being redundant, although I don't know how. But it does not appear to have redundant AC.
Okay. And then what did they say? An empty chassis uses like 35 watts?
Something like that, yeah.
Pretty low, and I'm assuming the optics probably aren't going to pull a whole lot. So it's a pretty low power unit, so... Surprising. Yeah,
at the switches that we use for the IX, they say their spec for the typical power draw is 232. Now that's bigger. There's 48 ports. Mm-hmm. Well, 48 SFP and 16 QSFP. But so it's bigger. But yeah, that's you know, eight times the amount of power.
For sure. Well, I mean, yeah, that many ports, it's gonna, I mean, it's just gonna require it. It seems pretty logical. Let's see here. I think we've beat that one to death. So let's talk about another Ubiquiti topic. Andrew Thrift threw out there that UBNT hired, I think, one of the engineers from PFSense. He pulled them over not too long ago. I'm not sure the fella's name or when precisely it happened, but. I think he was speculating you'll see a UTM, a Unified Threat Manager, come out for Ubiquiti. Or, you know what, I mean, their edge router infrastructure seems like it's probably got enough oomph, at least the larger models, to be able to run some kind of UTM inside. I mean, it's just a Linux distro anyway, right?
Yeah, I think PF is based off of one of the BSDs. But, I mean, it's, you know, it's a similar setup.
Right. But I guess the concept would be you could have some kind of light IPS built right in that you could configure from Unify as well as you think maybe inline virus protection. That's a big one for some people.
Yeah, it's, you know, they do have their DPI stuff that you can do on the Unify Gateway. And so this looks like it could be a huge increase in that regard, you know, beyond just traffic classification into, you know, actual management of that. Seems like this guy would do really well for that.
Gotcha. So this really, this sounds to me like they're really trying to strong on the enterprise environment, right? So they already have the, what is that, the Edge Router X, the little guy, the little five porter, right? And he's, was he like $45, $50, right in the neighborhood?
Yeah, something like that. It's you know, down in the, you know, cheap MicroTik territory.
Okay. Yeah. So adding this to their profile, I think, can only help. This is something I was, frankly, I've been asking MicroTik forever. Why don't they add some kind of IPS into their KVM? You know, their meta router thing, have some kind of Suricata instance or something, right? Tylera, I think initially when they were doing a lot of testing, it was all with Suricata, which is a intrusion prevention system. And I think Thrift is a big fan of it. I've briefly looked at it, but I'm not that smart a guy to be able to knock all that stuff out.
I recall that the layer 7 performance for those tile processors was pretty amazing. So they actually use them in a number of the existing like IPS, IDS systems. So it's just needs to leverage that power.
So I'll just ask, do any of you guys use MetaRouter in production?
I've never used it for anything.
Have you ever tried using MetaRouter for anything?
I think I tried it one time, and it doesn't like send a graceful shutdown when you do a reboot, right?
So
I've definitely used it in a couple of places previously. I've had reasonable success with it, but there were earlier on there were a few sort of game-breaking bugs. Last I heard, like, it seems to be reasonably stable. I just haven't had another use case for it as yet. So, I saw some guys at the MUM were using it as well. The US MUM I last went to. Ricky and the guys from Who's Dishes MUM, they were using it.
ISP Supplies?
Yeah, ISP Supplies was using a 1100 with a bunch of meta router devices on it as part of one of their demonstrations. So seem to be working right.
So demonstrations and proof of concept things, MetaRouter is great. But running MetaRouter in production, I really do not recommend it.
Yeah, I saw how Cisco just recently using the KVM technology in their IVR and ASR routers. They're opening up so third-party manufacturers can actually deploy apps right on their routers. And I was thinking, that's funny. MicroTik's had that forever, but I haven't really seen any traction. I haven't seen anybody like...
I assume there's a license for that.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing's free. So
that, I mean, like, to me, it seems more useful to do the reverse, to have, you know, instead of having a, you know, dedicated router that runs VMs, at least on this, you know, these smaller scales that we're talking, to have an x86-based network appliance running something like Proxmox, where you would run router OS as one virtual machine, and if you had to have something else running, you run it as another virtual machine in the underlying hypervisor, not on your router. Because if you reboot your router, everything's rebooted. You know, whereas if, you know, you can reboot your routing instance and, you know, not lose whatever else it is, you know, Suricata or whatever you're running.
Yeah. Or, I mean, to that effect, or rather to that end, if you're running MetaRouter and you do an upgrade for whatever reason, say there's an open security exploit where you have to upgrade MicroTik and you were to do that, it could introduce another bug that would just break all of your, you know, your infrastructure inside. Whereas if you went with a hypervisor, all of those instances are separated out, right? They're they don't necessarily have to play with each other. They can be completely on their own and independent of each other, which honestly, I think that's how I want to do. I've got kind of a project that's cooking, and I think that's how I'm going to attempt to do my next deployments, is just do all x86 virtualized. So I don't have tremendous throughput needs, at least right off the bat, so I'm thinking I could probably get away with it. Although I've heard good things about the CHR, the new drivers they're using for VMware are supposedly working pretty well. I don't know. Have you guys heard anything throughput-wise, what people are getting on those?
I've got a couple of them running in production now that have been working fine. They're actually running on Microsoft Azure, so there's a bit of messing about to get the images compatible for that and uploaded and running, but they have been quite reliable. I need to do some actual throughput tests between the Azure data centers and see what their upper limits are. It's just would be CPU utilization, I'd imagine, at the moment. I can't do the public ones though, because we're paying for all that bandwidth. So
fair enough. All right. You guys have anything else on that one, or are you ready to move on?
So, with MetaRouter, right, and with using hypervisor rather than MetaRouter, it's not all of the things that you guys mentioned are completely valid, but it's also about more than just that. Because if you go with MetaRouter, you don't have the standard management tools. You are completely missing on all of the goody management tools which come with a proper hypervisor, right? And you are also completely missing on any scalability. Because when you deploy proper hypervisors on x86, it has huge, great horizontal scalability because it's already built into the hypervisor and it already has all those scalability tools, vMotion tools, high availability tools, and everything else. So when you need it into the future, you already have all that because it comes with your hypervisor. But on a MikroTik, you don't have anything, right? You don't have any way to live vMotion guests across routers, right? There's mm-hmm. nothing there. You don't have any templating, you don't have any provisioning, and of course this would be for a bigger environment, but we all know that smaller environments tend to become bigger environments, right? So you are missing on management features, you are missing on high availability features, you are missing on all the good stuff there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I was in my head right now, I was just thinking about a good use case, right? Say you have a remote location and you need to run a specialized probe, right? So you put it in MetaRouter or whatever, you know? I mean, to me, you've got a small sort of dedicated appliance that's good on different temperature ranges that can work there. But I also instantly thought in my head that there's now a lot of good x86 devices like the
just get the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, the Pi or say like the Intel Nooks, right? Those little x86 things. They're super powerful and super tiny, and you could still run a hypervisor on that and do the exact same thing in a small footprint with good temperature ranges. So I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, backups and all of that. You know, I personally, and from experience, because I messed with MetaRouter quite a bit, and I also found tons of bugs in it, and I won't even get into that. But I really personally, from experience, I would not recommend running anything with MetaRouter in production.
Okay, fair enough. All right, so let's move on. One that's interesting that I think affects a lot of people is there was a Mimosa firmware upgrade that was released just recently. And Mike, you probably have a few more details on it than I do.
Yeah, actually there's been a couple of releases. Within the past week or two, there's been both a 1.4.1 for the point-to-point line and a 2.0.2 for the multi-point line. I only knew about the 1.4.1 afterwards. I mean, I get all their notifications. I was still trying to schedule myself to roll out 1.4 beta that I got 3 months ago that I've had time to schedule. And there's just, you know, as typical with them, there's a ton of stability improvements, a ton of performance improvements. Like, it's just everything is always up with those guys. You know, they rarely seem to have regressions in firmware functionality.
Gotcha. Any high points that you know from there? I remember some people were having some Ethernet issues, right? Were these addressed in here?
At one of those 1.4 or 1.4.1, I forget which one, one of them claims some Ethernet improvements. Of course, you know, that's fairly vague. You know, what was fixed, and you know, how many different types of Ethernet issues are there? You know, I don't know. I would imagine that it doesn't include everything. I know that the Ethernet has been one of the bigger issues. Not that it's like a catastrophic issue, you know, it's one of the more common problems.
Gotcha.
Trying to find a change log to go through it and like not finding one. Oh, there's one. Yes. Stability, higher power in certain bands. It's all good stuff. One of these was fixed that I actually received a beta firmware for, or like a test firmware for, was polarization mismatch. If you you know, being on like on the B5C, it's connectorized, you could wire the vertical port to the horizontal, you know, on the radio to the horizontal on the dish, if you know, not labeled properly or not, you know, synchronized with your other team properly. And with its auto everything, it's always trying to adjust things on a, you know, per polarity, per chain basis. And it didn't initially have the intelligence to learn when it was wired wrong. And so it's trying to change, you know, output power or channel on a certain port, and it's not seeing that change properly on the other side. You know, it's something that, you know, that they shouldn't really have expected, you know. They should expect people to wire it properly, but...
Gotcha.
I had one that wasn't.
And the mimosas we're talking about are the magical radios that do auto everything, right? You just kind of throw them up, point them in the wrong direction, and they just auto-tune themselves, right? Is that how that works?
Yeah, and they've, you know, and then they've added different ways of basing, you know, how auto everything makes its decisions, you know, which algorithms it uses. Basically, it's in auto everything, in real time, as it's passing data, it's also doing a spectral analysis of the entire band and determining if there's a better channel to be on, from a couple different perspectives. But, you know, basically, you know, bit error rate, you know, is this other channel expected to perform better than the one I'm on? And because it runs two independent simultaneous channels, it can actually move one of the channels there, test it, and then, you know, run that in production, and then move the second link to its next better spot. You know, changing power, you know, all that stuff. I wish every radio had that
auto
really.
Everything, yeah. For you guys that aren't familiar with them, I'm sure you'd be quite surprised. And then price wise, they're fairly price efficient too, right?
Yeah, it's under $500 for up to a gigabit of throughput. Well, over a gigabit of throughput, but you know, it only has a gigabit port, so you can't use all of it in one direction.
Yeah, fair enough. So to me, that's a heck of a deal. Moving on, because I got a lot of stuff from Mike. There's another one that he put up about FAA tower regulations in the 50-foot to 200-foot range. There's some new stuff out there. Maybe give us the high points. Anything interesting on that?
Basically, what it has come down to is the Crop Duster Association has lobbied the FAA for changes in how towers that are 50 to 200 feet, because you know, 200 feet tall, then is fully within FAA regulations in terms of lights and paint and how you do everything. And there's, you know, different circumstances where, you know, shorter towers under, you know, fall under those guidelines.
I would just like to add that that is 15 meters to 60 meters.
For all the savages in the world, yeah.
Oh, come on. The metric system is the one more people uses.
As Josh Luthman likes to say, what system was used by the only country that has their flag on the moon?
Actually, by this point, that fog is completely white today, so nobody knows anymore.
Yeah, didn't we try and send a probe before, and you guys had done some metric measurements on it, and it blew up?
Oh, yeah. There was a case like that, yeah. That's they didn't convert properly to metric, and the probe crashed. But yeah, the flag on the moon is white. Nobody knows anymore. You have no evidence you were there.
I mean, it was all recorded in a studio anyway, so...
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's that, of course.
It was all fake.
And now we have a new audience.
good times.
On that topic, it was... So in that 50-foot to 200-foot range, there's a lot of... wind power industry does a lot of test towers, and they'll have the smallest, lightest duty, you know, Rhone 20 or 25 tower. They'll build it 190 feet tall to be just underneath the FAA regulations, and they'll put these small instruments on it, you know... It's a guide, like it's perfectly legal, but it's so small. There's no huge antennas on it that when the crop dusters are going through the fields, they don't necessarily see the tower until they're in the tower.
Fair enough.
Or they're in the guy wire, and it's you know they're still working on all the details of the regulation. They just said, okay, FAA, you start figuring something out for this. But they do leave restrictions like these towers are not towers by buildings. They're not in developed areas. So that if you have, you know, like every tower that's in a suburban location wouldn't be covered by this policy because you're already not flying there because of houses or trees or other structures.
It's just for
the random, you know, WISP tower or cell tower or wind industry tower that the pilots may not be seeing.
Gotcha. So WISPs, kind of out in the boonies, which are virtually all WISPs, should probably take a look at this for paint and possibly lights, huh?
Yeah. I know that the WISPA attorney is all over it, and you know, as soon as the FAA does something with this, you know, WISPA members will, you know, be the first to know.
Gotcha, and we'll try and relay that over. Speaking of WISPA, you had a note in here about the WISPA elections coming up. What'd you have to say about that?
Well, actually, it's already happened.
Oh.
Let me see here. We do have a turning... Well, every year they rotate about half of the board. I'm trying to get the other post up. And so this year, half of that half is completely new blood. And that's what I think most people like to see is, you know, some of the veterans stay by to kind of help guide the new guys, but then also, you know, have new guys with new ideas come in and, you know, maybe take the association in a better direction. Ones that were elected this year, Dennis Burgess, most of you will know him from Link Tech, Jimmy Carr, name's familiar, although I assume he's not the, comedian from the UK. Garth Nicholas, he's a WISP not too far from me. He's a pretty good guy. Alex Phillips, he's the current president. And then, Mike Whelan. He's in Oklahoma, and he was actually the one that ran the the backhaul competition last October at the Wispa show that quickly became the infamous backhaul when one of the vendors withdrew from competition, and there's all kinds of spitting matches back and forth, and so Wispa decided, well, we're not going to do that. But, you know, he put a lot of time into it, did everything, I don't think any of the tests were necessarily done improperly. It's just one vendor didn't like how it shook out, so they didn't participate.
Fair enough.
And there goes Tomas. Oh, he's back.
He's back. So, some new blood in the Wisp election. That's always good. New faces. When are you gonna make a run, Mike?
I'm asked that every year. I usually have people telling me that I should be running. I think that most of the board members say that they spend an additional 15 hours a week, 20 hours a week doing Wispa related things. I already work 80 or 90 hours a week. I don't have another 20 hours.
And half of that's on Facebook, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. Some of those this past spring, I joined the agenda committee at much urging, because I was getting pretty vocal about what I thought should be happening at shows, and someone said, well, join the committee so you can do something about it.
Fair enough.
So I did.
Yeah, that's
and
what they
said. Actually, I think two or three of my recommendations made it through to sessions that are at the show. So
cool. I guess that's a word to everybody, right? If you want to see something, get involved.
It looks like Mr. Miller decided to join us.
Yeah, it looks like we popped in right here towards the end. This is Justin Miller out of Virginia. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing good.
Excellent. So we were just about to talk about Fail to Ban. That was a topic Mike brought up recently, I think just a couple of days ago. So Fail to Ban basically is a little software package that you normally run on a server that if somebody is doing some inappropriate behavior, trying to log in via SSH over and over and they're failing, or I think maybe trying to do certain things to your web server over and over, it'll create a firewall rule and block them. Is that the gist of it? Is that how you guys have used it? I usually use it on any sort of server that I have external access to, which isn't a lot. There's a couple, like a web server so that our marketing people can remotely log in and administer things, and I'm just very paranoid about those sorts of things. So I usually have zero access, but the ones I do, I run sort of like Fail to Ban and other apps. How about you guys?
Yes, what actually was the instigation for that one of my VoIP upstreams. I got a auto fills the account as needed, and I saw like three transactions on one day, and I was like, I get less than one a month, how'd I get three in one day? I assume they just charged it wrong. And that's what I told them that, and they said, you know, check your account for odd activity. So I checked my account, and I'm like, well, no, I don't have any, unauthenticated calls, that I thought I had that locked down, and sure enough, no one, was calling, Taiwan from my PBX. Actually, Taiwan's probably not that expensive. Kazakhstan, there we go. That's probably expensive. Sure enough, that's all locked down. What I had noticed was that someone had been logging into an account from a server in France, in one of my, actually my friend's phone, and like there was a series of 4-hour calls that were placed to some phone number in South Dakota, and all these calls were placed like 2 minutes apart, and they were all like 4 hours long. And I was like, "What? That's extremely odd behavior. Wait, how did this guy even get in?" So I changed the password. I And then I remembered that that ATA at one point was compromised. And so I thought maybe what happened was the ATA was compromised. They got, you know, they saw the MAC address of the ATA. They saw the TFTP server, and they're probably going to, you know, pull the TFTP server and just pull the new password, and away we go and not get anywhere. And so I, you know, I changed the password. I then set up a fail to ban on my, well, it was already running up, but I changed some of the options on it so that anyone that hits my TFTP box, you know, part, a portion of that, you know, now falls under the purview of fail to ban. Not, I mean, that's not going to stop them if they have the correct file, but hoping that that stops people from blindly fetching files based upon guest MAC addresses and keeps them out of my box.
For sure. So it's keeping brute force attacks from making their way in by detecting those and then locking them down in the firewall. I actually had a friend of mine, I think it was Jimmy, the guy who is one of the Cacti programmers. I think he used fail to ban and then would have, when it got failed to ban, he ran an alternate script that would log into the MikroTik and add him to an address list. Bop. So it'd block him on the gateway too. You guys done anything interesting with it?
Yeah, it, actually, I've been doing some of that already. I was trying to figure out how to get to work with my NetX mess setup, and it looks like I'll have to just run two separate syslogs. On my old syslog, I had it set up to be watching. Failban was watching it, and then it's just setting up another action. You know, you can set up any number of actions to occur, and it just, you know, pushes out a you know, fire up roll to my edge MikroTik. You know, I've been debating whether I should turn that from a firewall rule to a black hole route.
Gotcha. You know. So you haven't locked yourself out yet, have you?
I've got some rather generous ignore blocks so that I can come in from several places and not screw up.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Thomas, I have to think that you've probably got this running somewhere in your infrastructure.
Oh, like other SIP servers without fail to ban would be, oh, I don't even want to imagine.
I got 600 emails this morning from fail to ban that's now watching Asterix.
We ran it on all other Asterix boxes. I recently, actually, we got quite heavily attacked on our Zimbra mail servers, so what I want to do is also set it up on Zimbra. I haven't had time yet, but you know, just the, like, the attackers of course didn't get anywhere. It was just an SNMP or SMTP attack, right? But it's still better just to fail to ban and then just don't let them even try to break in into our system. So
After I did my Asterix box, I'm thinking, what other boxes don't I have this running on? And then I was like, oh, yeah, Zimbra. I just replaced Zimbra. It's probably not running on there. There's several guides out there on how to set it up. It's pretty easy for Zimbra. I had a lot of sections that weren't working until I realized that all the guides I was reading were written for single server environments. So it was expecting all of these log files on one box. And being as though my mailbox servers aren't technically exposed to the public, you know, those log files weren't present on the public server, and I probably spent an hour trying to figure out why it wasn't working until I realized I don't need it. But yeah, it, I can send some links over to you.
Cool. All right, we'll have to get Mike to pop some of that good stuff up on the Facebook page, which he's probably updating right now as we speak. He can't stay off of it.
I don't Facebook at all.
Ever, never. And I've never seen you walk around with two phones in your hand at the same time either. That's not happened. So we're actually nearing the hour mark, which, so we're trying to sort of keep these in there. We're adding show notes now to our cast and then making them available to everybody. And I'm hoping that sort of helps us stay on track with all this stuff. So we actually have a few more things, but since we're nearing that hour mark, I say we roll those over to the next one. Something I was thinking about doing that somebody had kind of suggested that, you know, they like listening whenever they hear us go down tangents. They pick up little tips or new things, you know, something they hadn't thought about. And so I thought, why not just introduce every week kind of a tip of the week? I had a guy call me yesterday, day before, something like that. Or it was actually he contacted me about a week ago, and I helped him a little bit. And then he wasn't ever able to really solve his problem, so he gave me another call back. And he was creating an IPsec tunnel between two locations, right? Both of them had static IPs. And he would, you know, verify everything was right on both sides, but he just couldn't get any traffic to pass, you know. And he verified that all of his policies were right and everything looked good and his NATing statements were there. And so I jumped in, and sure enough, it was creating the SA key, so it actually looked like it should be passing traffic. It just wasn't. And then I tried, well, just for fun, to set up, say, a PPTP or an L2TP tunnel, and it wouldn't come up on the far side at all. So then I immediately went to his firewall, and of course he had a block all on his input chain. So just as a tip, you got to remember that these tunnels actually have to be allowed into the router, right? So the remote sites have to be allowed, not just the forward chain, the stuff that's going to pass through. You have to allow things into your router for those tunnels, right? So IPsec, I think, is UDP port 500 and protocol 50 and 51, not port, but protocol, right?
So actually, it's UDP 500 for IKE, mm-hmm. UDP 4500 for NAT-T, and then IPsec AH and IPsec ESP, depending on what kind of IPsec tunnel you are doing for the layer 4 protocol.
Boom. Drop the mic, Thomas. There you go. So a little tip, just remember firewall rules, right? So if you're banging your head against it one way, try something else. See if that works. And sometimes that'll trigger your memory, spark something, and you'll remember to update those input rules. So something I've done in the past, which I continue to like to do, is Miller, what are you working on? Anything interesting, anything new?
Not a whole lot. I've just been trying to keep my head above water at work. So much work. It's like our busiest time of the year right now, so...
It's cool.
A lot of work.
I know a lot of people say that's a good problem to have, but you don't get paid anymore when it's busy, right?
No. we just got an A5, the small A5, and a bunch of C5s from Mimosa. We're going to try those out. And we also got the Ignite point, multi-point link, which we haven't tried. We've had a couple of opportunities to use it, but after doing the... link calculations, it wasn't gonna work out, so we don't have anything that fits in the reduced distance limit for that particular device. So keep looking, keep trying, do some new stuff.
Cool.
But yeah.
Are you excited or just exhausted?
I'm exhausted.
That's what I thought. All right. Oh, I mean, you're all done moving and everything, right?
I don't know if you can see behind me. There's a gigantic mess behind me. This is the office, and it's just stuff all over the floor because I don't have any shelves or anything.
Well, you've got all your crap there. That's half the battle.
All in one room now instead of multiple rooms.
Awesome. So. That's good, man. All right, Mike, what do you got cooking?
Well, on the moving topic, I may have mentioned it the last cast. I don't know. I didn't spend much time in the last one, but... I'm still moving into the house that you know, Kate and I got this spring, and we're starting remodeling on another house to move into by the end of the year. So I'll have two moves, probably within 6 months of each other. But the new house is twice the finished square foot, attached heated garage. It'll be a much nicer place.
That's cool.
But on the actual work front, we are thick in actually finally getting the contracts nailed down for our exchange in St. Louis. And one of the partners of the company, they not only want us in there, but they also want us in at least two of their other markets as soon as possible. They're hoping paperwork done in 3 to 4 weeks and for us to deploy three new markets by the end of the year.
Very cool, man. I'm hoping to get you in a couple of my data centers as well pretty soon if we can make it happen.
Yeah, it's always about trying to line up, you know, in these bigger markets where you have tons of data centers. It's always all about, you know, getting the fiber between your locations. That's the hardest, most expensive part.
Yeah, and, I actually might have a lead for you. We'll have to take that offline, though.
That's great.
All right, Foxy Coxy, what do you got cooking?
As you know, we've been picking up resellers around the globe at the moment, but we are currently looking for some sales folk based in the US. So we're looking to get a couple of people on board and help us approach and just talk to more internet service providers, WISPs, hotspot providers based in the US, and get a physical sort of presence there with people on the ground who can help out and everything. So if anyone knows any good people, feel free to refer them over.
All right, and that's Andrew Cox, and he's talking about Bright Wi-Fi, the hotspot sort of the amazing hotspot system that they have.
So hotspot management, MDU management, like billing, accounting, reports for people that want to do the marketing side of those things, and automated deployment for all the MikeTik devices we roll out. So,
all right, so
getting stuff out of the box, plugging it in, and bringing it online within a couple of minutes.
All right, and how do they contact you, Andrew?
So the best one is just andrew.cox@brightwifi.com. That's andrew.cox@brightwifi.com.
Perfection. All right, Mr. Kernak, what's cooking on your side of the pond?
So much work. I've been working pretty much nonstop on Unimus the last a long time now. And the last couple of weeks have been quite busy. I've been pretty much coding and programming for 10 to 12 hours a day. There was a huge release last week, which was added support for like five vendors, fixed a lot of bugs and stuff like that. And I've had a couple of people actually that deployed in thousands devices into Unimus, so I've ran into some scalability issues and stuff like that. So I've actually completely rewritten the database layer in the last week and stuff like that.
You know, so, little things like that.
Just working on Unimus as hard as I can, still hoping for open beta in about a month and a half. So
you're my hero. Hey, have you woke up dreaming about coding for Unimus yet? Is that happening?
So many dreams about coding. Oh yeah.
You know you're in danger at that point. Yeah, something's very wrong for you. That's cool, man. Well, I'm glad to hear you're still pushing through. You still got a smile on your face. I don't see any ligature marks around your neck. You haven't tried to end it all, so I'm sure there's light at the end of the tunnel, and everybody I talked to is excited about it. I've actually talked to several people, so there's a lot of buzz building up, so people are getting hyped for it. It's going to be awesome. I'm trying to think if I've got anything going. I'm on the tail end of a Lynda course, and it sucks every bit of life out of you. As you can expect, at this point, they've taken the training wheels off, and they expect me to be a big boy, and I really need somebody to hold my hand and powder my butt and tell me I'm doing a good job. So it's, I don't know, it's just different. It's still fun. I still like it, sort of, when I don't hate it. But no, it's extremely fulfilling. I can't wait to get through it. On top of that, the work life is getting ever busier. Learning lots of new things about servers. At some point, maybe we'll talk about doing JBOD with ZFS and how all of that stuff sort of magics. It kind of, I'm an old school server guy, right? And I think of raid cards, and then JBOD, you don't do raid anymore. And it's like, what? You don't? No, I don't understand. You know, and so it's like ZFS is kind of magic and integrates all of that stuff. And it's still sort of breaking me. But I'm going to get through it. I'm pretty sure I will. Especially once I kind of tuned my inner Andrew Thrift and kind of get into that mindset. You know, I'm going to go get a wig and spike it straight up. It's going to be perfect. I'm going to have that nailed down soon. So I guess this is pretty much the end, guys. Right at about an hour. Man, we're really getting on the ball. We're really nailing these things down. I'm amazed. Again, the easiest and best way to get a hold of us is through our Facebook page, the ever-vigilant Mike Hammett. As always, taking care of the group, finding new people, alienating some of those new people, but still finding new people. if you have any suggestions, anything you'd like to see on here, any new topics, more background information on anything that we just randomly talked about, which happens a lot, which is honestly my favorite part again, then be sure to reach out. And if nothing else, thank you guys for listening and come back soon.